The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 455 for Sunday, June 23rd, 2013.
And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in tips, questions, and cool stuff found. We share some tips, we answer some questions, we pile up the tool stuff found, but also the cool stuff found, and squirrel it away for a day when we can just blast it all out, because it seems like that's the right pattern for us. And that's not happening today, but it may happen next weekend, because I happen to notice that the queue is really big here in Durham, New Hampshire, on this fine Sunday morning, caffeinating myself while chatting with one of my best friends, and all of you here in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here with, I have a cup of coffee in my Apple mug that I got at the Apple campus store. John F. Braun.
Hi, John F. Braun. How are you? You caffeinated well? Or are you?
Oh, I think so.
That's good.
Yeah. Did my own.
You did your own?
It was a pea berry, I think, coffee is what I had, what I ground up this morning.
Well, that's good. I suppose.
So other than suffering a bout of packet loss, which I am only subject to, I guess.
Yeah,
everything's great.
Yeah, well, you have received packet loss only, it seems, from everything you try to talk to. But every packet that you send is getting out just fine. That tells me it's your cable modem. Actually, when we think about it that way, right? Because you're sending packets out, and Skype is actually really good at telling us where the packet loss happens. Because otherwise, it's kind of a hard thing to measure, I suppose. But if you run Skype and you get into a call, we're getting geeky already, and you go to the window menu and choose technical call info, it shows you a lot of stuff. But one of the interesting things is that it shows you total packet loss and then send packet loss and receive packet loss as a percentage. And for me, receive packet loss is sitting at 0%, but my send packet loss, John, is at about 15%. And I'm guessing you're seeing something quite the opposite.
Yeah. And so sometimes some things we tried here, just a mini troubleshooting thing for network problems. So one, on a lot of cable modems or some cable modems, or at least mine here, you can check the status page, and I checked that. That's typically at 192.168.100.1.
We'll put a link in the show notes to that.
And mine says receive power is 0 and transmit is 48, which is within spec.
Yep.
Though I think the transmit's kind of high.
I got to be honest. I know I used to run here at like 36 on the transmit, but nowadays, because I rearranged my network, I'm actually running higher than you. I'm at 50. But they say if as long as it's below 51, you're fine. And thus far, it's proven true. So
I'm going to blame my ISP.
Yeah. Well,
it could be the cable modem.
Yeah.
I'll just swap it out.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, that address is on every cable modem that's out there. They're all DOCSIS compliant these days. We have graduated beyond the proprietary cable modems of the old days.
And the other quick test they did, so I had problems because it does Flash and Java and all that. So there's something called pingtest.net, but I just did a simple ping from the terminal and pinged macobserver.com and would see loss there as well.
Yep.
And that,
Now I know what the problem is.
It could be a fire. You heard the fire engine, right?
I did. We all did.
Maybe Josh. That's it. I bet you there's a piece of network equipment going up in flames. That's it. Okay.
Yeah, that's great.
Problem solved.
Yeah.
All right. But anyways, I was dropping ping packets, so that was a bad sign as well. So it's not a.
But it's interesting because when you drop ping, so what John's talking about is just going to the terminal and what he typed was ping space macobserver.com, but you could do ping space apple.com or pick anything, and many web servers will respond to pings, but not all. But if you get one that does, you will either get all of your things back and it'll kind of send one per second and it'll show you. And then when you're finished, hit control C and it will give you a little summary. And so I let it run for like 10 seconds, but you'd have no idea which direction the packet loss is happening. You just know that the packet isn't making it fully round trip back to you. That's what a ping is. It says, I'm going to send a request to that computer out there and I'm going to get it back. And then it measures the amount of time that it took for that to happen. But like I said, with Skype, it tells us that, you know, it is in one direction and one direction only, because I'm getting 100% of your packets, which is fascinating. So It's good. It's good. All right. Let's move on to, let's do some of our questions. Ed, actually, let's do some tips, because I said tips first in the order of the thing when we started with the people and the stuff. So let's do Ed. He says, in regards to your discussion of using the Apple TV for showing photos, there's another fun thing you can have it do, and that is to display a Flickr search. We often go on vacations to different places, and so we will search Flickr for pictures from that state or place. We put it in a slideshow, and we get to see where we're going to be before we get there. Just thought I'd tell you about it. That's actually excellent, Ed. Thank you. And we got another tip on the Apple TV thing. I had said that iTunes needs to be on all the time in order to stream your iPhoto library to the Apple TV. That's incorrect. The Apple TV will cache some amount of the pictures there, so it doesn't necessarily have to be on. It does initially to get it set up, but once you've kind of told it, this is what I want to do, the computer can go to sleep, and it's all still good. So it's good. It's good. That's good.
You know, I even found a little tidbit, Dave.
Yeah, tidbits are good.
Little tangent, but I think it may be relevant because it's something I want to revisit. I'm like, you know, I seem to remember this thing called Front Row that Apple had.
Yeah.
You do a lot of this stuff, including displaying slides and all that. And I tried to activate it on my various computers here. And typically what you could do to activate it, you could either hit the button on the IR remote.
Is it still there?
Or
does Front Row still exist in Mountain Lion?
Well, I'm going to answer that.
Okay.
The thing is, you can make it exist. So normally it doesn't. I think they actually pulled it out in Lion as well. Because to get it to work, you used to hit Command Escape, and eventually it would come up and let you access, you know, it was their shot at a media center. I don't know why they pulled it. But I'll post the... But if you look at this link here, it actually explains how you can... what files you have to bring over... from an older machine, or I guess OS installation, if you use something like Pacifist to, and it seems to work on, the reports say, it seems to work on Mountain Lion. So I pasted a link to a discussion that talks about that. We can put the notes here. So if you want a blast from the past, so I may try this just for kicks.
That's interesting. That's how you roll, John. All right. So, you know, we were talking about SMS and from cell phones and trying to sort all that out. And Rick had a good tip. And Rick's tip was using a website called freerevcell.com, freerevcell.com. He says, I have been using email to text messages because I have a non-data iPhone or non-data phone and texting's not easy. And using freerevcell, I can enter a number and it will tell me whether it is a cell phone number. And if it is, it will give me the SMS email address to use. The website looks totally spammy and all that stuff. But, you know, I typed in our numbers, John, and it came up right with them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they've got access to the data somehow. My guess is this has to be in some sort of public or semi-publicly accessible database. So, but yeah, freerevcell.com. So we will put that in the show notes too. And I see the show notes being created before my eyes by all of you in the chat room at macgeekab.com/stream. Good morning, everyone in the chat room, or good afternoon, or good evening, or whatever it is for you. Thank you very much for joining us. It is always a blast. John, I think we have... do you have any more on that, or are we ready to roll on this this comment from Dave related to cell phones and all that good stuff?
No, let's go.
Let's let it roll.
Hey guys, my name's Dave. Just a quick follow up on episode 454. There was a question about doing SMS from a computer. It's not exactly what he's looking for, because I think he said he wants to do both iMessage and text from the computer. But another alternative for sending SMS from a computer, which you guys were talking about, is Google Voice. The only downside, it would obviously require a new number for sending from your Google Voice number. Except they do have an option now to import a number, I believe. So if you wanted to keep your number, you can for, I want to say it's $20. But anyways, if you got Google Voice, you can send from the computer either through the web, or there's a couple of standalone apps I think I've found in the App Store. There's extensions for Chrome and Safari and whatnot. So that's another option if you wanted to be able to send and receive text from the computer. And the nice thing is, if you're doing that as your main texting platform, there's also iPhone apps and whatnot, so you can get the SMSs on your phone as well. So, Richard, you can cut me off.
We will cut you off. Yeah, I that's brilliant. I use Google Voice all the time. I occasionally use it for texting, but I actually have, so it's, but it works totally well for that. And so thank you for reminding us to remind everyone else that is an option. I use Google Voice with my iPhone as my voicemail, and there's a way you can do that. We'll find the website that explains how to do it, but you type a series of numbers into you have to get a Google Voice account first. And then you go into voicemail and you say, attach it to my existing cell phone. And it has you type in a series of numbers. And what it does is it reroutes your non-answer forwarding from being sent to AT&T or Verizon's voicemail to being sent to Google voicemail. And the cool part is I then get my voicemails as emails with audio and the transcription. Now, Google's voice's transcription is sometimes gibberish, but over time I've learned to interpret it and can actually usually get the gist of a voicemail before ever hearing it, and sometimes without ever hearing it. So that's good stuff. Do you use Google Voice, John, or no?
No,
of course. It's fun.
Well, I've run it a couple times actually on my computer to make a free call, because it does have a mic driver and stuff like that.
Yeah. I forgot you can do that with it too. That's right. Yeah. And you can do, it's interesting. You can do, like, if you had to do an overseas call on your cell phone, Google Voice might be the most economical way to do it, because you run their little app and you put in the number and then it dials the number, but it also dials your cell phone and then marries the two calls together. So, and their rates to you, or whatever your minute rates are, just for, you know, domestic calls, which for a lot of us now are just free, but, or unlimited, I should say, not free. We pay for the unlimited service, but then you get your overseas call for quite a bit less than the carriers typically charge. But that's how that goes. Any thoughts on this, John, before we keep moving on?
No thoughts.
Keep on moving. All right. Well, I want to talk about our first sponsor of the day. And if you are not using Squarespace to host your website, you probably are doing too much work to make all of that happen. Squarespace.com/MGG is where you go. But you just get started right away. You actually start picking a template before you ever even give them your name. You go there, you click get started. And if you go there today, and I think they'll have this up for a couple of days, they've got this cool, geeky audio looking template on their own website. But you click get started, and then you pick a template that works for you. And I mean, these templates are beautiful. They're pro designed. They are tested. They take like 3 months to design and test their templates before rolling them out to you. And not only does that mean that they're totally polished and totally pro, but they're also tested on every browser that they can think of, both desktop, mobile, tablet in between, you know, every one of them. I don't know if they test for IE6. There's no reason to. If anybody's running IE6, you should just like get rid of that. But I think they test for pretty much every other browser other than IE6. And that's excellent. In fact, I hope they don't test for IE6 because it's terrible. But these templates are fantastic. And then once you build the template, you can pretty much do whatever you want to do with it. You know, if you want to run your blog, they've got, you know, WordPress on the back end. You can import stuff from your existing WordPress blog. So if you hacked something together somewhere and you've sort of been cobbling along with that, just slurp it right into Squarespace and then you're just good to go. If you're running a business and you want to have a little shopping cart or a big shopping cart, you can. And they've partnered with merchant services providers so that on the back end, you just say, I want to take payments, and boom, they take care of that for you and then get you your money. It's totally smooth, totally, you know, easy to get set up. And when you're, you use their templates, right? But if you want to bring in your own pictures and artwork because it's your website and you want to have stuff that's representative of you, you just drag them in from your desktop right into the browser and it's there. It's and you can move stuff around and change text, and you've got all these different features on the back end. It's really, even if you're not going to host a website, just go to squarespace.com/MGG and play with it, because it's a cool engine. It's cool to see the way they do things. And who knows, you might actually want to sign up. When you do sign up, your coupon code, and this is sort of at the very end of the process, because like I said, they don't ask you for your credit card before you start doing anything. You create the thing and then they start asking you for these things, which I think is really smart. At the very end of the process, the coupon code MGG6, because this podcast is being recorded and released in the month of June, which is the sixth month of our Gregorian calendar year. So MGG6 is the coupon code to use that gets you 10% off of whatever you buy. So check it out. Squarespace.com/MGG. We appreciate having them on board, and we appreciate you checking them out, because you're doing yourself a favor. Just check it out. What's the harm? Have fun with it. That's what this is supposed to be about. All right, John, you got Joe ready to roll, or any thoughts?
Yes, I do.
Square?
And I have a better answer. Number two, actually, I can hear you better. It seems our packet loss problem may be going away.
Hey. Oh, no. Yes, don't speak too soon.
It looks to be getting better. So anyways, yeah, and I actually sent a follow-up to Joe here, because my initial answer was not quite correct.
Yeah, but nobody knows about your initial answer yet, so tell us everything.
Great. So Joe writes, hi, John and Dave. Really enjoy the show. Love the chapters. Oh, thank you very much.
Oh, that's good to know. Yeah, we've gotten quite a bit of feedback on the chapters, all of it positive thus far. So thank you for that.
Yep.
And thank you, Michael, for that. Sorry, John. I just
absolutely. And then on another note, any tips on getting a MacBook Pro late 2011 model's SD card reader working again? So as some of you may know, there have been various interfaces on MacBook Pros, and this one has a SD or secure digital memory card reader, which personally I thought was a silly move. I always liked Express Card. But what's been happening, he says, it's been absolutely fine, but now SD cards no longer appear in the Finder sidebar or on the desktop when you insert one. I've tried the SD card in an iMac and it shows up fine and gives no trouble in the camera it came from. The card doesn't show up in Disk Utility either when inserted. I've checked the Finder prefs. I've got all the sidebar and desktop options. Okay, very good. CD, DVD, and HDD. I did a little Googling to try to find an answer, but the only solution I found involved invoking a terminal command to kill the Finder, which sounded a bit scary, so I was hesitant to try it. Do you think it could be a hardware issue? And is there any way of narrowing down whether it's a software hardware issue? Yes, there is. So let's pretend that I got it right the first time. So at first, I didn't know quite where to go with this, because I didn't think that I had a machine with an SD card reader. As I mentioned, my MacBook Pro has the Express Card 34, which does allow, I use USB SD card readers.
Sure.
So either Express. So I didn't have.
I didn't initially have one.
Apple built. I didn't think I had a machine with a built-in Apple one. But as it turns out, I do. My Mac Mini has one. At first, I think I used it once and just ignored it, because I mean it's really inconvenient. It's on the back left of it, and it almost looks like a ventilation thing if you don't know that it's an SD card slot. But to determine if it's a hardware problem, you want to see if the Mac can see it. And where you're going to do this is depending on where you are. But eventually, you want to run the system info application, and typically that involves, you know, doing about this Mac and then either more info or system report, and you'll eventually get this report to come up. And then you want to look at the hardware category, and you may have to click on the triangle to open it up, and then you're going to see a whole bunch of devices. Now, at first I said, you know what, I'm not quite sure what type of device this is, so look under USB or maybe SATA, or there's a PCI category, and then duh.
I'm gonna hop in here, John. Just to get there, I just didn't want to gloss over this in case people didn't know. Apple about this Mac, more info, and then system report will launch the report that John's talking about. So go ahead.
Yes. The other way you could do it is if you do a, I think that'll still work.
Option Apple.
Well, no, you could also get to it. It's called system information. Well, at least on this machine, it's called system information. But yep. Okay, so it may vary depending on what system you're on, but eventually you're going to get a full system report. And so, yeah, so the category is hardware. And then, Dave, I didn't notice this. I thought it was a device that hangs off another bus. For example, a lot of things hang off of the USB bus, like your keyboard and probably your mouse and Bluetooth and IR receiver and a whole bunch of stuff. So
and
I thought it made
doesn't,
show up there.
Huh?
Well, in this case, it actually shows up under, well, duh, I didn't notice this. There's a card reader category. And it's actually, and then I saw people suggesting online that it may be a PCI device, and it's a PCI, as far as I can see, PCIe device.
Yeah.
Because whatever ports, it says built-in SD card reader, and it says vendor ID, device ID, a few other things, and then link with. That's typically a statistic given with a PCIe device, and things can be X1, X2, X4, X16, and you'll also see this, I think, with some graphic cards. They'll show you how many bits. And then it actually shows the link speed. It says 2.5 GT/S, which I believe is giga transactions per second.
Yeah.
So that's an approximate link of the level. So if you see something in the card reader category, then it's probably not a hardware problem.
Yeah.
Contacts are dirty.
I'm going to point something out, though, on my iMac downstairs in the office, which has the card reader. I have the card reader category, and it says it shows me this same information you just described. But if I go to USB on my high speed bus in the hub, it says internal memory card reader, and it's
really
So it shows it to me as a USB device, but maybe yours is different. It would be surprising because Apple doesn't usually reinvent several wheels, but yeah, mine is definitely on the USB bus.
Okay. Well, at least on this mini, which I think is a 2010. Yeah. Mid-2010.
Yeah.
It does not show up in the USB category. It just shows up in the card reader category.
Isn't that interesting? Huh.
So, actually, that's a good tip. So, you know, and the thing is, if you're looking for hardware diagnostics, I mean, it doesn't hurt to go through all the categories.
Right.
There's a lot of them. And they keep changing the interface that the device uses sometimes. So, but yeah. So, if you see it, again, I mean, he's gone through all the other steps in that it's not the card. You know, it could be the card's broken, but you put it in another machine and it works in your camera. So it's not the card. So either if it shows up, then I would think, yeah, maybe dirty contacts or something like that, or maybe blow the dust out of there, is that it's not making a good connection, even though the computer can see it.
Well, it could also be a software issue. It's worth booting from your install CD and see what it reports, in recovery partition. I got to catch up. Boot from your recovery partition and run system information there and see if it shows up, because that's going to have, you know, that guaranteed set of drivers, whereas your main installation, something could have gotten corrupted. Or boot from it should mount right there. If you put an SD card in, it should mount even from the recovery partition. Disk Utility should see it, I think. So that's yet another option to try.
That's all I got to say.
That's what you got to say. So, all right. Assuming that the NSA is not monitoring this stream between us, and they're not responsible for your packet loss, which they entirely could be. I figure we've kind of had this discussion. We had this discussion a couple of years ago, but you actually brought it to the table, John, but I figured this was a good time for us to talk about securing your browsing. And I don't want to make a big deal out about this NSA thing. They've been monitoring us forever, right? I mean, this is not new. It's just new in the way that it's sort of the Guardian made it public and, you know, created this big scare thing about it. But it is good to know, and it's good that people are aware that, yes, you know, this happens. It always has happened. It's going to continue to happen. But there may be times when you want to browse privately. And there are ways of doing that, and it's actually gotten a lot easier. A couple of years ago, John, we talked about something called the Tor network. And I'll let you briefly explain what that is, and then we'll talk about some implementations that have happened in recent years that make it very easy to use this. But let's talk about at a sort of at the core foundation what this is, and we'll see if we can't explain that and then tell people how to use it. So you want to start with what Tor is, John?
At a very high level, Tor is a network that will anonymize and secure your web traffic. How's that for a summary?
I wouldn't say secure. It is not necessarily encrypted, but it will anonymize your traffic.
Okay. All right. Most of the implementations I've seen, well, actually, yeah, a lot of times you may have to dig into the client or server, if you want to be a server, and enable encryption. Okay. So that's not necessarily given. But the important part is that it's an anonymizer in that it will make the IP address that you appear to be coming from not you.
Yeah. But it's what's interesting, you know, normally, John, if you run a server and I connect to you, you have to know my IP address because I want you to get packets back to me. Right. So in order to do that, you have to know who I am. But what Tor has done, and Tor it's an acronym, and I'm afraid I'm going to get this wrong, but I think it's the Onion Router. Right. Is what Tor stands for. Is that right, John? Someone will correct me, hopefully, in the chat. Okay.
Since they're doing so much onion terminology, then I would say that's probably a good guess.
Yeah. So and what they do, it's so cool. Instead of me connecting directly to you, John, I connect to another computer in the middle. But just one computer in the middle wouldn't be enough because that computer would then contain the data that would say, I know that Dave talked to John. And so that could be compromised right there. So they actually have three hops in the middle. And by the time my data gets to you, John, no one hop knows both ends of the connection. The one in the middle knows neither end of the connection, right? So I hop to point A. Point A knows me. Point A hops to point B. Now point B knows point A, and point B knows the next hop, so it hops to point C, and then point C hops to you. And so all you know is point C, and everyone, it's completely anonymized. You don't know who I am. I don't even necessarily need to know who you are, which is where things get really interesting, because you can have, normally websites have IP addresses like, you know, whatever, 207.58.150.216, right? That IP address can be traced to a person or organization, but through the Tor network, you can actually set up websites that have .onion addresses. So you don't even know what their IP address is. It just gets you to them again through this anonymized network. And you can, as John said, you can encrypt your traffic on both ends. Although encryption could reveal something about you if your computer is encrypting things using a key that is unique to you, right? So if you have a certificate, if you're a server and you want to offer end-to-end encryption, that may or may not be a smart thing because that certificate might be traceable back to you, right? Isn't that right, John?
I'll have to think about it. I'm reading an article on it, and it does imply that the onion, at least onion routing, almost always includes its own encryption.
Okay. Yeah. So, I think, right. I think it's encrypted in the middle, but as far as end to end encryption, that's not always happening. And again, you may not want it to happen for certificate reasons, but it used to be, John, you'd had to set up. In order to get this to work, what you do is you run this thing called Vidalia on your computer, right, John? And then you point your browser or whatever applications you want to use with this to a proxy server, and it, you know, immediately, like 99% of the population, the eyes just glaze over. It's like, oh no, 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 forget it. That gets wacky. Now that that's 1%, even still, for those of us, it's like, it's a big process, right, John?
Well, it can be because, the traditional thing would be you get something like that set up as a server, and then you would have to reconfigure all your clients to go through that proxy server to provide you with Tor ability, the benefits of Tor. And yeah, I think that gets beyond most people.
I mean, it's even a pain in the neck for you and me, right? Because you got to go and reconfigure your browser, and you got to make sure it's configured right. Otherwise, you've just given up all the anonymity, you know, that you wanted to... That you wanted to maintain. So they have built the great people that work on this Tor project, which is all open source and all of that good stuff, at torproject.org. They have created something called the Tor Browser Bundle, and they have one for the Mac. They have two for the Mac, a 32 and a 64-bit version. Most of us these days will probably run 64-bit, but they've got it for Windows and Linux, and you can probably compile it for your own platforms if you choose. But this is all in one. You launch this thing, it fires up Vidalia, sets up all these wacky network connections. And what's cool is you can kind of look and see where your endpoints are and in what countries. It's just fascinating. I mean, it routes your stuff all over the world. It's like being James Bond. Right. I mean, we see it in the movies where they're like, oh, I need to anonymize my traffic. This actually does it. And you could be set up and running it and playing with it in 5 minutes from right now if you wanted to with this Tor browser bundle. So it's fun stuff. It's good. It's cool. Fun to play with. So that's did you set up the Tor browser bundle, John?
Did I set up which?
The browser bundle.
Oh yeah. No, it's awesome. And it actually helps understand how this thing works here. So as soon as it launches the browser, I think the first thing it does is it says, oh, well, here's your IP address.
Mm.
I'm like, that's not my IP address.
Right. It's how well, you appear to the other end. Yeah, exactly.
It is if you're going through Tor, and it's actually interesting because I was able to run iStat menus and verify. I'm like, okay, hold on. Let me just double check here. I'm like, nope. My IP address is still, Optimo Online. But as far as Tor is, anything going through, that browser going through Tor has another IP address. So it's interesting to see the separation here.
Right.
That you could still be on your software that doesn't know about this Tor thing still works as it should.
Yeah, and actually that's an important distinction, right? You know, the only thing running, if you run the Tor browser bundle, the only thing running across the anonymized Tor network is your Tor, the browsing that happens inside the Tor browser. Anything you do in any other browser or even like your mail client or anything else is still sent in the ClearNet. So if you're doing something, and there's sometimes good reasons. I mean, you might have... Especially for people in countries where internet access is still, very closely scrutinized, and depending on where you visit, you could get in trouble. This has been a handy thing. I know some journalists that use it to get data out of countries that otherwise are, not too keen on data getting in or out. So it's good. Obviously any technology at all, but especially a technology like this opens itself up to potential nefarious uses, and Tor is not without those for certain. I mean, we've got, the website that keeps getting talked about is Silk Road, right? Where it's like this online eBay style marketplace for everything you couldn't possibly buy on eBay. But that stuff is sort of a natural byproduct of any time you create anonymity like this, but it's very interesting. It's very interesting. So, if we're done with Tor Browser Bundle, I think that leads us into the sort of the last piece of the puzzle. If you want to head down this path, right, John, or are we not done with Tor Browser Bundle?
Oh, I think we're done with the browser bundle. The piece that I think you're going to mention is one that I had not yet set up here, though. I think in concept, I grok what it does.
Yep. So yeah, the as I said, the browser bundle only protects that one browser, or only anonymizes that one browser. And it's possible you could, you know, make a mistake. You could go and send an email that has something you copied or pasted out of the browser. And now it's possible to link your traffic back. And because your email wasn't sent in the, you know, across the Tor network, now you're compromised. So you can run something called Tails. And that, too, is an acronym that I don't entirely remember off the top of my head. But the concept is it is a static disk image, and you can burn it to a CD, but it is an entire environment for it's an Ubuntu operating system, but it's totally pre-configured. It doesn't save anything to its own disk, and it boots up in this Ubuntu system, launches the Vidalia setup to get the Tor network happening, and then every bit of network traffic that you do with inside this operating system is sent over Tor. They actually do have one little thing called the insecure browser or unsafe browser. In case you're in a coffee shop or something and you need to log into, you know, the agreement page or whatever, you can do that. And then, you know, and then the rest of your browsing happens there, and the rest of all of your internet activity. So whatever app you might run inside this is totally secure. And you can, on the Mac, because I started trying to figure out, okay, how would I do this? And creating, you could burn to a DVD and boot from that. There's a way that you can jump through some hoops and create a bootable USB key. And those are probably the most secure ways of doing it because nothing else is running on your Mac. But if you're not totally crazy, you could run it inside of something like Parallels, which is what I did. And you just set it up as the installation CD. This image as the installation CD of a Linux operating system. It never installs the OS. It just boots from the CD and everything is up and running. And it works. I mean, it's 5 minutes, depending on how comfortable you are with Parallels, you probably could be up in 5 minutes with this too. But, it took me about 10 'cause I had to figure out, you know, I'm not always the fastest one, but I got there. Bullheaded persistence is the, that's the name of the game for me. That's the secret to my success, John. I'm too stupid to stop sometimes. So I figure it out. But yeah, it's an interesting thing and fun to play with. It's one of those things that just makes you go, oh, wow. There's so many smart people out there figuring out all these interesting little paths. Of course, there's the tinfoil hat folks that I know and love and often join. Say that the CIA are the ones that set up Tor in the first place to monitor the activity of people that wish to remain anonymous and that they found it very helpful. But, you know, take that with however many grains of salt you usually take those things with. Yeah. Anything, John, any more thoughts?
I want to add one other program. So there's another one which I think is worth looking at.
Yeah.
And I had highlighted at a point in the past, and it's from HannyNet.com.
Yep.
Who does some utilities you may recognize, like Waterroof and IceFloor, that have to do with network and firewall configuration. They write something called Anonym, A-N-O-N-Y-M. And it's really a front end to a network setup, but it incorporates anonymizing proxy servers. So I think it's a separate mechanism from Tor.
Okay.
And it operates at a lower level. And that, from what I recall, when you run this, it actually fiddles with the your network stack. So everything appears to be coming from the anonymous network. So that point I brought up before where, yeah, so in this case, from what I recall, what I ran it, if you run it and then you check your IP address of your machine will actually have changed. So that's kind of neat. So that's another thing to experiment with if you want to appear to be coming from somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's really what all this is about. Is you're appearing to come from somewhere else or appearing to be something else. And it's about anonymity. And as Kiwi Graham in the chat room mentioned, you know, it is really important to stress the difference between anonymity and encryption. And encryption I haven't done a ton on Tor, but in my experience, certainly the data that I am sending and this Tails thing constantly reminds me anytime I fill out a form or, you know, do whatever, it says you're sending data unencrypted, which which is kind of how that, like I said, how that works. You know, with a certificate on the other end, you know, that could link back to one party or the other. And it, depending on the site you're going to, that may work out, which is fine. I will point out that Google does not like to serve search traffic to Tor clients. They start saying, oh no, you've requested too many things. Probably because there's a fixed number of endpoints out there, and everybody's probably hammering Google, and they're saying, you know, but it appears to be coming from this fixed number of machines. So I think that's why, but I'm not sure.
Well, I've seen that with Google every now and then, especially if you're set up on a network where they're doing NAT.
Yeah.
And you get an IP address behind a router that appears as a single IP address, and you're a large company. I've actually seen this triggered in enterprise situations where it's like, whoa, too much stuff coming from this IP address. Cut it out.
Okay. So that's what it is. Yeah.
I think they just have in general, like, well, kind of some of the stuff, like a TMO I noticed the other day, I don't think you can make a comment over, within a certain amount of time.
Right. That's right.
There's a script that detects that as well, because it figures somebody's trying to spam us or something, I guess, or harvest the site. So it says, no, 15 seconds. And that's enough to slow down the bots, I guess.
We assume. And we actually have I forget the timing of it. It might be 15 seconds for the first one. But if you then post another one, the time that you have to wait increases, and it begins increasing exponentially, so that you know, for the guy who needs to post two comments right away, it's not that big of a deal. But if somebody tries to post 15 comments over the course of several minutes, that's impossible. Smart, right?
All right.
Hey, I wanted to talk about this last week. It's a pretty cool thing from a company called AMP, Antec, A-N-T-E-C, Mobile Products. I got this cool little, and that's sort of the key, device called the Gain, G-A-I-N, and it is a Bluetooth receiver and transmitter for headphones. So Bluetooth headphones are awesome, especially if you're like at the beach and you want to keep your iPhone sealed somewhere but still want to listen to music. Bluetooth headphones obviously solve that problem. And in fact, I will point out, you know, if you don't have something like a LifeProof case or a one of the Obex cases, putting your iPhone in a relatively decent quality Ziploc bag is a great way to protect it both from water and like sand and all that stuff. And you can still see and use the touchscreen through a Ziploc bag. So bear that in mind. So if you're going to the beach, throw your iPhone in a Ziploc bag and you get some Bluetooth headphones and you can still listen to music and you're good to go. But what if your favorite headphones and the headphones that you spent lots of money on aren't Bluetooth? What do you do? That's what the Gain is for. So it is a Bluetooth receiver. And again, a transmitter. You can use it for your phone headset too, if your headphones support it. You plug your headphones into it and you Bluetooth pair the Gain with your phone and it just works. And you've got shuttle controls on it, so you can play and pause and update the volume and even answer calls right from this little thing. And it's tiny. And the best part is it has a little clip. So it's kind of like, you know, it's a little smaller actually than that iPod Nano, John, that had the little, you know, the little clip size thing. It's even a little smaller than that. And the battery runs, for me, I had it running they say the battery will run 6 hours. I believe it. I don't think I ran it quite that long, but it works great. It sounds good. You know, it's using high quality Bluetooth, you know, the high definition stuff. And it sounds great. So, you know, for the summer, and it's $32 at Amazon. So it's not like you're shelling out a ton for this thing. So there you go. That's the Antec Gain. I just started playing with it and it was like, oh dude, this is a no brainer. And so I wanted to make sure everybody knew about it. I wanted to save it for a cool stuff found show, but since we've been putting that off and summer time's here, I thought some of you might appreciate hearing about it sooner rather than later. So that's the AMP Gain. Fun, right, John?
Indeed.
Yeah, comes in different colors, but it's like $32.
Nice.
Yeah, I know. Simple. What are we moving on to? Oh, another thing for the summer, John, because you might be traveling some and you might want to talk about, you might be out of the office and you might want to let people that try to email you know that. So, John?
Yes.
Yes. You're going to lead us in?
Oh, to Michael.
To Michael.
So, Michael, as you may have guessed, wants to do something about vacation. So he's saying, it's that time of year. We're supposed to be on vacation this summer, right? Is there a way to set an I'm on vacation, will return in September message in Mail, or more specifically, Mail.app, which comes with the OS? I tried it recently by using a mail rule and got complete chaos. The rule was every message... All right, every message, I have two mailboxes, one personal, the other on a Windows server. All right. Okay, so he's defining a rule. So yes, all right. So the first part of the rule, I guess, is that you say if any of the following conditions are met. Now, he said every message. And I actually put into an article that had an important warning here, but actually, even at this level, Dave, I would say that that's probably not the best choice for a rule like this, because he mentions he has two mailboxes. What I'm going to suggest is that if you say... over here, all right, if you make a rule and you say, so you still say if any of the following conditions are met here, but rather than every message, Dave, I would say account is an option as a rule parameter. And then when you click on account, like in my case, it lists the three different mail servers that I subscribe to. So it sounds like you probably want to do that to start. Okay. And I think that would have prevented this problem. But then the second thing that happens is typically, all right, so to get back to his letter here, when I set the away message, my contacts got bombarded with hundreds of emails from me. Needless to say, I was not popular when I returned. So and he gave a screenshot here. So one, I put in an article that goes over this. But the second warning here, and you got to be careful of this because you may do this by accident or on purpose, hopefully by accident. But when you after you create a rule, it says apply a rule to all to existing messages or something similar. Your answer to that, you want to say, or I'm sorry, let me get the terminology here. All right, so it'll come up and say, do you want to apply your rules to messages in selected mailboxes? And you want to say, don't apply. I think what happened is he accidentally hit apply, which looks to be the default.
Yeah.
So the thing is, I was saying, oh, take every message and reply to it.
Right.
So he must have had the mailbox with all his messages still in there highlighted, because that's what the rule, I think, was asking is, you know, whatever, wherever I am now, you want to apply this rule you just created. So, however, if you do want to send an email to everybody, then that would be the way to do it.
Right. Yeah, that's one of those weird things when you're creating any kind of mail rule that you need to, it's going to ask you, do you want to apply this to all of the messages that are in your inbox or all the selected messages? And if you say yes, it does. And sometimes that's important because you've created a rule to process things. And obviously it wasn't working in the past. And so you know, you've got this new rule. Do you want to apply it to the stuff that's already come in? And choose wisely, I think is the message there, Mr. Braun.
Yeah. Or, you know, like I found in the past when doing a mailing list.
Yes. Test.
Test not once, but maybe twice.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. You know, the other thing for out of office stuff, a better, certainly you can do it from your Mac here, but your Mac is not, the functionality inside your Mac, at least built into Mail, is not robust enough to say, hey, like if you send me an email and I'm away and I have this rule set up, Mail is going to reply and say I'm out of the office. And you get that and you say, okay, great. You know, and you say, I'm going to be back on whatever, you know, Tuesday. And then an hour later, John, you say, yeah, okay, well, I know Dave's not going to be back until Tuesday because I just got this bounce. That's awesome. But I'm going to send him some information because I've got some information I want to get off my desk. And I know Dave won't deal with it till Tuesday. And then you send me another email. This rule will send you yet another, hey, by the way, I'm out of the office until Tuesday. That can be a little bit obsessive and distracting because you don't need that information an hour later. You know, presumably, you're able to remember, you know, that sort of information across the span of 60 minutes. And mail's not smart enough to do that. But most servers that offer this functionality are. And it's sort of a self-protection thing, because these servers don't want to get don't want to have the ability for someone to turn them into a spam machine. Because what could happen is you could send me 50 emails and spoof the from addresses on all of them. And then I would reply to 50 random people, or not random, 50 people that you chose, saying I'm out of the office. And now I've become a unintentional spam responder. So servers, and if you use Gmail, this functionality is built right in. You can do this vacation autoresponder, but it will only send a response to one person every 4 days. And it's intelligent enough to manage that. And you can set days where it starts and then stops, so you don't forget about it when you get back from vacation and have people 4 days later saying, hey man, you know, you're still bouncing email to me. You need to turn off your thing. Won't fix your voicemail message that we all forget to change when we get back from vacation, but at least it manages that. So.
Right. And I think, yeah. And the consensus from the, peanut gallery, also known as the chat room here, and I would tend to agree with, is that if you can make it a server side rule, and I think, for example, Exchange lets you do this. I've used Exchange recently, and it'll let you create an agent, but last I checked, you don't have to have the client running. And I think the observation is that it's a pain in the neck to have the client execute these rules. If at all possible, toss it on the server, just right, as you said, and a lot of servers. Now, the other thing is he may want to check with whatever ISP he's using and seeing if he can get to the mail server and set up such a rule if they offer it. He wasn't specific. Well, he said he's on a POP implementation, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, your server may or may not support doing this, but like I said, Gmail does, and a lot of them do. It's a very popular request.
No, actually, you're right. Even when I was with my old POP email, I remember I could log into my mail account and do a .forward, which is what I do now, to Gmail. But also, yeah, I think there was a out of office or vacation setting as well. So even if it's an old antiquated POP server, the ISP hopefully offers something above and beyond just POP.
Yeah, or move to a service like, say, Gmail that offers IMAP, sort of, and a lot of these other functions for free. Right? I mean, if you're still on POP, get off of it. Unless you know that you have a very specific reason that this is absolutely what you have to use, and then, you know, and then ignore our advice because you know better. But if you're just on POP because you're on POP, change to IMAP. Your life will it's so much better, because you can have this unified or this consistent inbox across, you know, all of your devices and or even all of your computers. You can reply to an email at work. And when you get home, you see that reply, or you check on your iPhone and see that reply. It's nice to just have everything in sync. It's a synced life is a beautiful life. That's what I said, Joan.
That is what you said.
It is. I know. Yeah. All right. I'm not sure what that means. Rob, help.
Hi, John, Dave, and Pete. This is Rob from Sydney, Australia. I wrote to you a couple of weeks ago about the an incorrect number of available updates showing up in the Mac App Store icon on my Macs. And you made some suggestions about fixing it. In the end, it didn't work, and I've figured out why. And now I guess I'll just have to live with it. Let me explain. I have 4 external hard drives, each of which has 5 partitions, one for each of 5 Macs that I want to back up. One is for the work machine at my office, and the other 4 are for various home machines, 3 Mac Minis and my MacBook. Each of the home machines backs up over the network using Carbon Copy Cloner to another Mac, which I don't bother backing up. And that all works fine. And then the work Mac, I plug the drive in via USB and it backs up directly. But all of them use Carbon Copy Cloner. And what Carbon Copy Cloner does is when it encounters something that's changed, for example, an app after an update, it archives that in an archive folder at the root level of the hard drive. So what was happening was all of these updated apps were the update was being stored in the normal directory hierarchy, but the out-of-date version, the old version, was being pushed into the archive folder. It's only when I discovered, when I checked on the work Mac, that it had updates for apps which weren't actually installed on that Mac, that I started to think about what was going on and whether it was related to the backup drive. And then also some of my backup partitions started to get rather full, so I did some cleaning out of the archives, including deleting old versions of stuff in the applications part of the directory tree. So as I cleaned up these drives, I was seeing the available updates dropping. And there's your clue right there. So what's happening is the App Store doesn't count out-of-date apps in Time Machine backups. It knows to ignore them. But if you have, as I do at home, a local clone backup of my various machines, it'll see the outdated versions in the directory tree within the Carbon Copy Cloner archive and say, oh, that app needs to be updated. Well, actually, it doesn't, because the one on your boot drive and also the one in the active part of the clone is up to date. It's just that the archive part contains the out-of-date version. So there's a little mystery solved, and I guess I'll either have to disconnect my local backup volumes when they're not actually in use, or I'll just have to live with a misleading update count in my Mac App Store icon in the dock. Anyway, I love your work, guys, and don't get caught.
Thanks, Rob. So I'm thinking about this, and there's a couple of options that might solve your problem. I mean, it's good to know that you found this, and I applaud your troubleshooting skills, because that's my goal here. That's our goal when we sit down and do this, is to really get you to the point where you're starting to think a little bit more about this. I don't expect everybody to listen to this show and take every single tip that we share and apply it immediately. It just doesn't make sense, right? You're not all going to have all of these problems simultaneously. And if you did, that'd be really weird. And I might have to take some time off and scratch my head about, how the universe works. But I don't have to, because it doesn't happen. But, you know, filing this information away and hopefully building this, you know, foundation of knowledge, you know, that at times you're like, hey, wait a minute, if I poke this and touch that, I remember, and now you're good to go. So you found that, and that's good. But I'm thinking, I wonder if the App Store relies on Spotlight to help decide what apps to update. It may not, but Apple relies, you know, Apple is in many ways, other than with, like, for example, Core Data iCloud syncing, which we won't get into. In many ways, Apple, you know, eats their own dog food, to use an oft overused phrase. They keep reusing these bits and pieces of technology. So it's possible they're using Spotlight to tell the Mac App Store what apps are there and the versions of them, and that way it's all stored in one database. So the way to test that is to exclude your clone destinations from Spotlight. And you can do that pretty easily in System Preferences. You just go into System Preferences, and you choose Spotlight, which is in Mountain Lion up at the top. And then go to the Privacy tab and drag in your external drives here. That will tell Spotlight not to pay attention to these for results. Now, it will it may or may not impact your App Store stuff, but certainly worth checking out, because that might be the magic answer. If it doesn't, though, the other answer is, you know, set up, and we've talked about this in previous shows, but you can set up your clones to mount just before the clone happens and then eject after the clone happens. And then that will certainly solve your problem, because the drives aren't online. So the Mac App Store will only be wrong during the backup process while the drive is mounted. So that's another thought. You got any other thoughts on this one, John?
No.
Okay. Well, that's all right.
Well, it's happened to me recently in that I think, yeah, the other day I plugged in an old backup drive with the prior version of the OS, and all of a sudden the App Store comes up and says, hey, you have 14 updates, wait. And I'm like, what? And I look and I'm like, no, those are up to date. Yeah. So I've seen it happen every now and then. So when you see unexpected updates, yeah, make sure or pull all the drives and then try again.
Yeah.
I don't know why they're so persistent in trying to update apps that are not on the boot drive, which seems to be what's happening. I don't know.
Yeah. Now somebody in the chat room, I will tell you who, Brian Monroe in the chat room sent us a link and said it could be apps that were purchased on a different Apple ID. But I thought it would at least warn me about those. Although I haven't tested that. All of our apps have been bought with my ID now that I think about it. So that's possible. We will put this in the show notes too. So thank you, Brian. It's awesome having you folks here in the chat room, because like I said, not only do you save us from perpetuating incorrect or incomplete information when we do, but you save the rest of your listening brethren having to wait a week to hear the correction. So if we issue something that's wrong or, like I said, incomplete, you know, you folks are right there. Awesome. 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 We're all geeks. We all help each other. It's good. You know, John, I've been fighting battery issues with my iPhone 5. And one thing that was chewing up battery was the Facebook app. And I even think the new version that just came out this week was a big culprit. It just seems to run in the background all the time, even though it's only supposed to run for 10 minutes, according to Apple's rules. But whatever they're doing, they're running it forever. And it just chews up a lot of battery. But even with that, I was having some weird things. And it hit me that I had not started fresh on my iPhone probably since I got an iPhone 3G, which was my first personal iPhone. I'd always just upgraded and migrated and upgraded and migrated and restored from previous backups, because it's such a pain, because you can't go and get individual app settings easily. I mean, you can use some of the stuff that we talked about last week with, DiskAid or Phone View, but that stuff doesn't always work for that reason. It works for the other stuff we talked about, but pulling settings around can get sort of wonky. So I started from scratch before I left for WWDC, like days before. And I thought, well, I'll just save my backup. And if it drives me crazy, I'll come back to it. But it really wasn't that bad. Kind of like the most recent, or not the most recent, but the time, whatever it was, 5 or 6 years ago, that I started my Mac fresh and was like, I'll just go through the pain. And with that, I could at least bring some preferences over that worked. But with this, I had to reset up everything from scratch. But you know what? I have way less apps on my phone. My battery is running better because I don't have, just all this stuff, and it gets rid of the cruft. And it probably took me the better part of an afternoon to get my phone to the point where it was like, okay, yeah, now it's doing all the things I need it to do. And then over the next week, there were those occasions where it was like, oh yeah, I don't have that app. And then I sort of rethought, do I really need that app? Yeah. Okay, fine. And I downloaded it and put it on, or say, no, you know what? I'm good. I can function with this and really not miss it. So it took some habit breaking and that sort of thing, but it's not so bad. So I just wanted to share that there's no great, revelation here or some huge tip, but if you've been resisting it, but kind of know in your gut that it's probably the right thing to do, go ahead and do it. And again, just shoot a backup first before you start over. And if it really drives you crazy the next day, you just restore from your backup and you're good to go. So that's my thought on it. Have you ever, you've only had one iPhone. Is that right, John?
Yes. And I've had to run a store on it, but no, I keep my apps pretty lean.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that'll go through every now and then. It's like, have I used this in the last month? I'm like, no.
So that makes me think of something I really want. And it looks like from what I've seen of iOS 7, we're not going in this direction, but how in iOS 6 now, when you get you download an app before you run it, the OS leaves this new banner like sitting across it so that you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Thought that was cool.
I want one that says old so that it does that for apps that I haven't launched in 30 days. I would love it because it's so easy, especially if it would like have a smart folder and it would just put all those things in there and I could go through and it said, well, this one I know I need, you know, but the rest, get rid of them. You know, like the one for American Airlines. Well, if I haven't traveled in 30 days, I probably haven't used the app, but I like to have it so I can do the passbook stuff and that, you know, those kind of things. Fine. But the rest, sometimes I download stuff and it's like, oh yeah, I don't use that. Get rid of it. So yeah. Anyway, there's my real revelation. All right. So we've got two tips that we can share. Let's do Felix first while we're on the iPhone thing. And, Felix reminds us on the iPhone that you can hold down the power button where are we here? Right, this was on the iPhone? Now I'm totally confused, John. Yeah. So if you're on your iPhone and you need to reset it, if you hold down power and the home button for 10 seconds, maybe 15 seconds, but if you hold down both, not just power, not just home, but both of them, power and home, for 15 seconds, it will force reboot your iPhone, which is a really handy thing to know when your phone just locks up and you can't get out of whatever you're in. So that's tip number one. And then tip number two, John, which is related, which I really like, is if you have an app running and the app is unresponsive, instead you can force quit apps on your iPhone, even if you can't pull up the little, even if you can pull up the trough, if you can't get out of the app, it doesn't matter because the app doesn't appear in the little trough when it's the frontmost app. So the way to do it is for this, you hold down just the top button and wait until the slide to power off thing appears and then hit the home button. I think, hit that and hold down the home button. What's the tip? Oh, I'm going to screw this up. Yeah, no. Okay. That's it. So you hold down the top button, wait till the swipe to power off appears. Don't swipe, release the power button and then hold down the home button. And, for about 5 seconds, and then that will delete, that will force quit whatever the frontmost app is. So I got us there. Whew. It was touch and go for a while though, John.
Ah. Very good. And then a follow-up to that is with pretty much any modern computer, though it's not necessarily documented, typically if you hold down the power button for about 5 seconds, it'll force shutdown, which is not necessarily what you want to do all the time, but yeah. If nothing else works, almost every computer will respond to that. Now, when it starts up, it may not be happy, but it's
better than pulling the power cord out. Because at least the hardware gets to spin down, you know, on its own. And you're not dealing with some weird, you know, arcing ground or whatever by pulling the power cord out. I've always felt that. It doesn't matter. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it doesn't matter, John.
Yeah, it could. And then kind of a little Mac side follow up to that, or at least on Mac, if you do Command Option Escape, that brings up a little force quit panel, very similar to what you just mentioned for the phone.
For the phone,
you
can
choose individual, and you can choose individual apps to force quit.
Sometimes, depending on how spiraled out of control your system
how hosed
is.
You are, yeah.
Yeah, how hosed you are. That's the technical term, John. How hosed you are. All right. You want to do Paul's thing here? Should we do this? Share Paul's tip. Paul says, maybe we'll wrap up with this. He says, I ran into this on my desktop iMac the other day. Text edit and yoink kept crashing on launch and asking to repair the library, which it was never able to do. I used the following steps to fix the problem and thought I would share it with you. And we will share it with everyone. Thanks, Paul. He says, if you have had an app constantly crashing on launch or asking for an admin password to repair the library on launch, try the following. Remove files from the following locations. You're going to go to the home folder and go to library. Now, users of Lion and Mountain Lion 10.7 and 8 will note that when you go to your home folder, you don't see library. That's because it's hidden. We've talked about that before, but the quick tip is to hold down the Option key and go to the Go menu and choose Library in the Finder. That will bring you there. So get yourself to the Library folder and then go to the Containers folder. Inside the Containers folder is all of the sandbox data for apps that have been sandboxed. And you can go through there. And in his case with TextEdit, he looked for something named TextEdit. Now it's going to be reverse domain. There's a more correct word, but it's going to be com in this case, because Apple made it com.apple.textedit is how the folder name is going to be. So you open, he says to delete the com.apple.textedit folder and open the app again. That can work, but I will point out that is, you are deleting all of the preferences for that app. So, I would say that is actually the last resort. The first thing I would try is again in the Library folder. And this is following on to Paul's tip. He says, go to Library and then Saved Application State. And in here, you will see likely a surprisingly long laundry list of applications. And again, they're stored in this reverse domain format, or whatever you're going to all tell me I should be calling this. But you will find something like com.apple.textedit here. And if you delete that simply removes the windows that were open previously. And every app is going to read this when it launches to try and restore its previous state. But if this data is corrupted, then it will crash if that's the case. So I would try this first. I would actually do the saved application state thing, delete that folder, try and relaunch your app. If that doesn't work, then going into containers or application support, depending on whether it's a sandboxed app or not. But thanks for the tip, Paul. This is good stuff. And it's a good reminder that we all have to look in home library containers for a lot of our preferences and that sort of thing, because that's where the sandbox lives. So it's good to reiterate that again and again. Right, John?
Sandbox.
The sandbox. At least we don't have cats playing in the sandbox anymore with 10.9.
So my neighbors have that problem.
Do they?
There's a new mysterious cat in the neighborhood that he's very friendly to me, but apparently he likes to use the neighbor's sandbox for
his business.
Unintended purposes.
That's right. That's where he goes to do his business.
Not the intent of the property owners.
I come to my office every day to do my business. The cat goes to the sandbox. I think it might be different. I think that's a good time to bring in the band as loud as possible. Do we have anything else to go through? Mr. Braun?
Not today. Now we'll try to get out of this, even though it's still choppy packet loss city here.
You sound totally fine. When you listen back to this, you're going to be blown away because you sound as pristine, perhaps even more pristine than you always do. So it's,
I should give you this recording and see how long you can listen to it. It's very difficult to only hear little bits and pieces of things.
You've done
it gets better.
You've done fine. I haven't noticed your, you know, hesitation or anything. Not any more than usual or anything. Okay. Well, we want to have you email us. And really, we love getting email and really anything from you folks. But email is a good place to start. feedback@macgeekgab.com is the address. You can send in your tips, your questions, everything. We do try to address everything that comes in there. We prioritize the premium stuff, which we'll talk about in a minute. But this week we were able to get to everything, and it's always a goal. So it's a goal we often hit. So feedback@macgeekgab.com. Right, John?
I'm not sure if I heard it, Dave, really, this time, because of all the packet loss, but I think you said feedback@macgeekgab.com.
I did. And for those of you that are premium members, we very much appreciate your support. You can visit macgeekgab.com for information on how to support us directly with a premium membership. And then those of you that are active premium members can use premium at MacGeekGab.com for prioritized attention. And but really, it's just about sharing the love. We really appreciate all of your support. As you know, we are working very closely. We are very close on getting you your first round of gifts. Those of you that had had earned them by the first cutoff, and actually with the time that it took, the second cutoff's not that far away. So we'll probably be doing this again. I don't know, the next 4 months or so. So we will keep an eye on that. We will keep you posted. It's good stuff. If you want to call us because say you're driving and you don't want to tap out an email, we appreciate that. Go ahead and call us at 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is?
4335. You can also Twitter us. The show is Matt Geekgap. I am John Efron. He is Dave Hamilton. The other guy is Pilot Pete. And the publication is Mac Observer, all on Twitter.com.
I saw Pilot Pete this week. Someday he'll make it to a show. I swear. Not today, though. He's flying again. You can visit us on Facebook at facebook.com/MacGeekGab. We publish, we publish it all there. When the show's posted, when the live stream's happening, when the show notes are up, all of it. And sometimes we wind up having some conversations because you folks ask us questions there. And so it becomes its own little microcosm of MacGeekGab goodness. Anything else, John, before we wrap this one up?
Now I'm going to have to start diagnosing this problem here. I think I'll
sounds like you got a Sunday afternoon.
I'll start with the nearest I'll have to find the nearest router in the neighborhood, so that's where I'm gonna start. Hey, if they're not gonna fix it, I mean, somebody's gotta do it.
That's right. Well, you know, this is one of those things though where it would be, I don't know about the strict legalities of this, but if you could say hop onto your neighbor's Wi-Fi network, I assume your neighbor has the same internet service provider that you do, and you could hop onto your neighbor's wireless network only for the purposes of testing their connection to see if they're getting packet loss in the same way. And if they are, then you know that there's a neighborhood-wide problem as opposed to just something localized to you.
Yep. Yeah, I know there's I think at least one unsecured access point around here.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I'll try that.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, we, again, as we did mid-show, but again, I will offer our thanks and echo your thanks to Michael Johnston for converting this show to AAC and adding all those chapters that so many of you emailed and Facebooked and tweeted to us that that you enjoyed. So we will keep doing those. Not that we had any intention of stopping, but whatever. The topic came up last week, so I figured it was a good time to ask. Michael, in addition to doing that for us, publishes the We Have Communicators podcast, a great weekly podcast about all things iOS, and the GetAppler.com site, which I'm sure is about to be picked up by Yahoo, because they seem to buy everything that has an R without a leading vowel. So GetAppler.com. Check that out as well. All right, CashFly, CACHEFLY.com provides all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. The podcast marketplace, as you know, includes Squarespace at squarespace.com/MGG, BB Edit from Barebone Software, Text Expander and PDF Pen, Disc Label from Smile, and of course, Gazelle.com to sell all of your stuff that you're not using anymore, at least your Macs and Apple and iOS stuff. All through Backbeat Media. All right, John, we made it to the end. There was something that didn't happen through the show, which is good, despite our connection difficulties. So go ahead and share the advice, if you would, please.
What? Are you speaking of not getting caught?